What's up, everybody? How is everyone doing? We are back with another live stream and another live stream on Brexit. We hope everyone is doing well this post-Christmas day after Christmas. We hope everyone had a really good Christmas. We hope everyone rested. And we are back. We're back to talk about some more news. And this time, Alexander, we have to talk about Brexit. It was the last live that we did before we took a day off. We took one day off. We didn't post anything on YouTube. We didn't do any videos for one day. And we took a rest. But we did a Brexit live stream before the full deal came out. And now we are going to do a debriefing on the Brexit deal. The good, the bad, and the ugly. So we will get through the Brexit deal, and you will deconstruct it, and we'll see what we make of it. And of course, we have all our great viewers in the Durag community who will also help us discuss the Brexit deal, and they will weigh in to let us know how they view the deal. And interestingly enough, Alexander, you are reading through the deal, which has finally been published, the full thing, because as you told me before we went live, we were just working with some outlines of some briefs, but you'll get into that. Let's just do a quick 1 minute hello to everybody wherever they're joining us around the world. And Alexander, how are you doing this post-Christmas day?
I'm doing very well, delighted again to be with our viewers today on Christmas, on Boxing Day here in London. And it's always a pleasure to be with our viewers on Boxing Day. And may I again wish all our viewers a very happy Christmas. And I'm sure we will all have a good, successful and prosperous new year.
What is Boxing Day, Alexander? Explain to everybody who may not be in the UK.
Boxing Day is when the churches reopen and people basically put money in the charity boxes. That was what it originally was. It's become a convention to speak of it like that here in Britain. The point is, it's a public holiday. Of course, today is a Saturday, so it can't be a public holiday, but we will have a public holiday on Monday. Then we will. The next public holiday will be New Year's Day. But Boxing Day is an important day in the Christmas festivities in Britain. I would add that, you know, until about the 19th century, Christmas festivities in Britain lasted for 12 nights. And what is known as a Christmas cake or pudding was originally a 12th night pudding. And that was what Queen Victoria, of a blessed memory, always referred to it as, right up to, until her death in 1903. So that gives you an idea of what it was, 1901, I'm sorry. That is what gives you some idea of what Christmas was. And the traditional Christmas dish was goose, not turkey for the most of the British people, but the aristocracy, of course, they had venison and beef instead. Turkey only came into Britain from America in the late 19th century, inspired by the Thanksgiving holiday. And we don't cook it anywhere near as well as the Americans do.
All right. Okay. Let's welcome everybody here. Of course, we have Danny James, the awesome Danny James, moderating. Of course, we have the great, the one and only Spartan Warrior Queen. I saw Spartan Warrior Queen in the live stream as well, moderating the stream. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for everything that both of you do, helping us moderate. Moon Swan Silverlight says, hey all, hope you had a good Christmas. Thank you very much for those wishes. Moon Swan Silverlight, JMM, greets us from Portugal. Jake Bullet says, another strong live, strong emoticon with the word live there. Darren from Wales is joining us. Anne is joining us. Welcome, Anne. Let's see who else is here. Lindell, how are you doing? Lindell, good to have you here. Alex, best wishes to all. Thank you, Alex, for that. Mm-hmm. Let's see who else is here. Stacy says, we missed you tremendously. Thank you very much. Immensely. Thank you very much, Stacy. Greetings from Bulgaria. Ivo, how are you doing in Bulgaria? Hope you had a nice holiday break. Let's see who else. Bulgaria is Orthodox. Are they on? Are you guys in Bulgaria celebrating on the 7th, or did you guys celebrate on the 25th? Just curious. Bulgaria. because Greek Orthodox, even though we're Orthodox, we're on the 25th. I believe Romania is also the 25th, if I'm not mistaken, and they're Orthodox as well. So just curious there. Hello to the Netherlands. Darren Alevi with our first super chat will knock it out. Speaking of Mishkin, Alexander, yes. Hope all you had a good Christmas. Did you get Mishkin something nice, Alexander?
Oh, absolutely. He's had lots of presents, as has his sister. This is probably somebody outside. This is what's making him so excited. But he's had a wonderful Christmas, and we've taken them both for long walks, and they've been running and doing all sorts of things. But we got them some very nice treats and presents, both things to play with and things to eat. So they've been eating quite well.
All right. James David says Canada is still here. Awesome. Awesome to have everybody from Canada joining us. Zisi Hronyabola from Melbourne, Australia. Great to have everybody in Melbourne as well. And in Australia from Lund, Sweden. Good to have you, Emil, here. Let's see. Happy Boxing Day to all, says Spartan Warrior Queen. Well, Spartan Warrior Queen, let's get to it. Hello, Susanna. How are you? Let's jump into it, everybody. Peter Johnson says, greetings from Brexit compromised Belfast, guys. All right. Awesome. Good to have you here. All right, Alexander, let's begin. How many people have seen the movie, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, by the way? Let me know.
I absolutely have. Lee Van Cleef and all that. And of course, it's an Italian spaghetti western. Very strange to watch nowadays, but really an amazing movie. Quite fantastic, mm-hmm. actually. Yeah, Clint Eastwood, I think, was the good guy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Boy, did they used to make really great westerns back in the
absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Great. All right. Well, a Western movie to talk about UK news. So, Alexander, let's get into it. Do you want to give an intro on Brexit, or do you just want to jump right into the good?
Well, I will make a quick observation. Of course, we've had the deal, which was announced on Christmas Eve, and I think that was not a coincidence, by the way. I think the government deliberately timed it that way in order to prevent too much scrutiny of the details of the agreement over Christmas. And there has been a chorus of commentary, all of which largely favorable to the British government. I mean, we were talking in our previous live about how Boris Johnson's communications strategy seemed to have broken down. Well, it has over the pandemic, but it certainly was in full operation over the deal that he's agreed with the EU. And it was striking to see people like Farage and most of the people who are, you know, the Brexiters in the media. They came along and they supported the deal, and they spoke very warmly about Johnson, including, by the way, Farage spoke surprisingly warmly about Johnson. And there have been the usual sour notes from the Remainers. But by and large, they are, you know, grudgingly accepting of this. And the arch Remainer in the House of Commons, Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, party to all that plotting last year in 2019 to try to get Brexit derailed and to get a second referendum up and running. He has now said he's actually going to vote for this deal, and he's going to get the Labour Party to vote for this deal. And some of the very strong Remainers in the Labour Party who were supporting the Remain position and who voted for Keir Starmer because they thought he was a Remainer, they feel very puzzled and bewildered. And this talk of resignations from the Labour shadow cabinet and of many Labour MPs disobeying Keir Starmer on this, not because they are leavers, dissatisfied with this deal, but because they are Remainers dissatisfied with this deal, because, of course, it finally, as they see it, ends our connection to the European Union. Now, how did Boris Johnson manage this thing? How has it been possible for him to persuade everybody that this deal that he's negotiated is in fact the great deal that he says it is? Well, the short answer is he did it by not publishing it. What he published and what everybody has been reading, and I think what many people have thought is the actual text of the deal itself, is a 34-page summary that the British government has published. They published this 34-page summary, and everybody read that and assumed that this was, in fact, the deal itself. In reality, the actual document was held back, and it was held back until today, until it was published about 3 hours ago by Politico, which is, of course, rather interestingly, a liberal US magazine. Shortly after Politico published it, the European Union also published it. The European Commission published it. I have been going, by the way, from the European Commission's text. Now, I will say this straight away. I have been comparing the 34-page summary, which Boris Johnson has provided, with the actual text. I have always and invariably found that when one has to study EU documents, you absolutely do need to look at the actual text. And the actual text runs not to 34 pages, but to around 1,256. So it is 1,256. It is a much longer document. About 800 pages are annexes. And I'm not going to pretend that I've plowed through all of the annexes in detail. But the rest of it, the bulk of it, if you like, about 400 pages that really matter, they are divided into basically two parts. Much of it is very detailed discussions about what happens to individual goods, individual industries. There's a section on fisheries too. There's a section on agriculture. And then after you've got through all the hundreds of pages of material on all these detailed provisions. This is very typical, by the way, of EU trade documents. It's only when you've plowed through all of that, when you get to page 283, that you finally get to what is the real crux of any of these documents. And then you arrive at the various legal and trade settlement provisions. And that's really the key. This is where the heart of any negotiation with the EU really matters. Because, of course, what the EU is concerned about, what really matters to lawyers, what's going to matter to negotiators, are the law enforcement and judicial mechanisms. And to begin with, what I discover is that the United Kingdom is or continues to be committed to the European Convention of Human Rights, and Article 2, definitions, and you go to provision 1. The cooperation provided for in this part is based on the parties and member states' long-standing respect for democracy, the rule of law, and the protection of fundamental rights and freedoms of individuals, including as set out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the European Convention on Human Rights, and on the importance of giving effect to the rights and freedoms in that convention domestically. Now, it's extremely important to say that the British government, as part of the divorce from the European Union, has been talking about opting out of the European Convention on Human Rights. They say that they have no particular reason to have the European Convention of Human Rights as part of British law. Tony Blair made it part of British law in 1998 by the Human Rights Act. It was supposed to be something that the Conservatives were going to reverse. It's now quite clear that they are not going to reverse it, because when it says on the importance of giving effect to the rights and freedoms in that convention domestically, it means that they're going to maintain it as part of British law. So that's one thing. So Britain will continue to be administered in that respect by the two European courts, by the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, which is, of course, not technically part of the European Union, but also by the European Court of Justice, or as it's now being called, the Court of Justice of the European Union, that changed its name slightly, that will continue to be operating, administering provisions of the European Convention on Human Rights in Britain. The European Court of Human Rights has said that it has power to monitor the administration of the European Convention of Human Rights in member states. That will continue to happen. It will not just be the British courts that will have the right to do that. So that's an important thing to say. Then the next thing to say is that, of course, if we look at the enforcement mechanisms, it's quite clear to me, these are the enforcement mechanisms for the entire agreement. It is perfectly true, as the British government has said, that the European Court of Human Rights is, sorry, the European Court of Justice is not mentioned in these enforcement mechanisms. It is also true that Britain will operate a, and the European Union will operate a zero tariff policy. That is definitely a win for the British. They are, in effect, agreed to be part of a free trade agreement. But that free trade agreement will continue to function on EU regulations, because that's absolutely clear when you go through the text of the agreement. And we see provisions, for example, about the EU, Britain not applying will continue to apply non-discrimination mechanisms. So that means it will not deviate. It will continue to align itself with the EU regulatory framework in respect of trade in goods. And indeed, not just trade in goods, issues like data security and integrity, transparency, and all those kind of things that the EU is increasingly involving itself in, that will remain. Now, the one thing I would say which the British have managed to achieve is that there is a mechanism for withdrawing from this regulatory framework. They can do so, they can give notice after, and after 4 years, 4 years of this agreement, they can start to pull out. But up to that point, because they are observing European regulatory systems, they will, in effect, continue in relation to changes of law in respect of those systems, continue to be subject to the body which administers those systems, or rather the two bodies, which are the European Commission and the European Court of Justice. So it's not the deal that Theresa May would have negotiated. It is a looser deal than that, significantly looser. The British do have ways out. They can continue to detach themselves from the European Union over time. But in the meantime, they will continue to be subject to the EU regulatory systems with respect to trade in goods. So you can see that the British have made some headway, but they're not fully there yet. So I would give this thing, this deal, not the rapturous reception that some people are saying. I would give it a C+, slightly better, certainly better than what Theresa May would have achieved, but far from being the end of the affair. I predict we will still have more Brexit videos and lives to do in the future, though I would expect that over the next year or so, this story will finally go into some kind of, it will quieten down into some sort of remission.
Okay, so what were the good parts that you liked about the deal?
Well, essentially that, as I said, the British are provided with a get out. They can leave. eventually. So it depends very much.
In 4 years, you said.
In four years, and then it can continue to roll over, and then they can start to give notice. They can say they can start to move away step by step from the European Union. That is the good part for me, because that means that the British are now free to start making their own deals with other countries. They're not tied perpetually to this European regulatory system. They're not, in effect, part of the EU single market, fully subject to this, to its rules, with no let out, as it would have been with the provisions that Theresa May was working towards.
Can they reattach, though? You said they could detach from the EU in 4 years. Can the reverse also be true?
Yes, absolutely.
As time goes along, instead of having leaders that move the UK out of the EU after 4 years, can you have the reverse, where the UK has leaders who reattach the UK to the EU?
That's exactly what can happen. That is precisely what may take place. So
that's the bad.
That's the bad, exactly. If you have a Keir Starmer prime minister, for example, he may decide that he wants to actually slowly begin the process of reintegrating Britain further in the EU. He can always amend this agreement, remember, and that might be what happens again. So it buys time. This is what this agreement does. In effect, it's another temporary provisional set up. It doesn't finally end anything. It is not the end of the affair. We will have a situation where either we move forward towards a more a Britain that moves more effectively out of the EU and its economic structures, or we will have a Britain that decides to reintegrate itself further towards the EU structures. But the reason why it's a C+ is that the decision is Britain's to make. It's not the EU's. If you remember, what happened with Theresa May was that it was essentially Theresa May, through the so-called Irish backstop, was giving the EU the power to decide which way it would go. Now the British have gained that power back. So in that respect, I think it is a C+. It's not all the way. Some people would have said that a clean break Brexit was the better solution, and it would have been finally and fully the end of the affair. This is not the end of the affair. There is still things that the Remainers can work with, but at least it gives the British a final route out.
Okay. So this is the ugly. We're going to skip the bad. You mentioned the good. This is the ugly, the fact that just as much as they can detach from the EU over time, they could reattach to the EU over time. And this is now in the UK's hands. But when you mean the UK's hands, according to the agreement, if it says it, does that mean that the next prime minister, or the prime minister after that, after Boris, whatever it is, the next government, can reattach or detach to the EU according to how they want to govern? Or does this go up for a referendum or a vote? In other words, who really has the power here? Is it the government that's going to rule, or is it up to the UK to decide?
No, it's up to the prime minister and the government. In fact, I'm not even convinced that if they decided to go all the way, they would need to consult the British Parliament very much. What they could do is that they could deepen cooperation with the EU to the point where the actual decision to join the EU becomes almost an administrative step. There would have to be a law to make that final decision. I mean, if the Britain were to rejoin the EU, there would have to be actual legislation passed. But it would be very simple legislation, because all the framework to deepen cooperation and regulation is there in this agreement. So it would be a very simple law to pass, and it could be done by the British government, and there would obviously be no requirement for a referendum or anything like that.
So, So the people won't really have a say.
I mean,
outside of who they vote for the next prime minister.
Exactly.
once that prime minister is in power, they could pretty much take the country in whichever direction they feel.
Exactly. That is exactly right. So if you want to continue to move Britain in the trajectory of detaching it ever further from the EU, then, as I said, you will still have to vote for people who are committed to Brexit. And that will remain the case for, I would guess, at least 10 years.
Right. And if you vote the wrong person, then it's pretty much just a technical mechanism to get them back in.
Exactly. I mean, they could deepen the process of integration very easily on the basis of this agreement, and rejoining would become essentially a technical matter. It would not be as complicated, nowhere near as complicated as it was back in the 1970s, for example, when Britain first joined what was then the European Economic Community, and it required vast legislative changes to achieve. Today, it would be much more straightforward, and this agreement could be used as the basis for it. So it's a fork in the road. You can move either way, and you have quite a long period of time in which the option of rejoining remains real.
Very interesting, very sneaky.
Very, very interesting and very sneaky. And I get to say straight away that it carries once more for me the imprint of Angela Merkel. It's clearly Angela Merkel who decided that she wanted to make this agreement. Remember, she's leaving in September. She's anxious that the German trade surplus with Britain be preserved. Apparently, she refers to Britain amongst her intimates as Treasure Island, because Germany exports so much to Britain, and German industries and German business make so much out of that. So she was not in the end prepared to countenance a no deal Brexit. And the result was that she made more concessions to Johnson than I think some of the more hardline figures within the EU would have wanted, because essentially the fact that there's, you know, zero tariffs, it's not frictionless, there will still be, you know, checks and things of that kind at the border, but because it's essentially a zero tariff regime, the Germans can continue to export their cars, their, you know, famous goods, their to Britain, maintain that surplus whilst retaining also the option one day of pulling Britain back. So it's very much an Angela Merkel deal, not maybe a, certainly not a Macron type deal. And some of the more hardline Euro integrationists will not be happy with this. They will feel that it gave the British too much. By the way, I would go back just to touch on the subject of fisheries. The EU basically got what it wanted there. The British will again have very restricted rights to catch fish in their waters. There are provisions for changing that over time. It will depend very much on the extent to which, again, a future British government is committed to rebuilding the British fishing industry. So we will see what will happen there.
Okay, so let's get into some of the bad outside of the actual agreements, the way it'll unfold, say, 4 or 5 years. For example, the court system. Mm. Is that's bad that the UK is still bound to the EU court system, or no?
I think so, because can I just say straightforwardly, I mean, when I say bad, I mean, of course, it's bad if you want to really sever the link. But the reality is, I mean, the British government says that, you know, we're no longer subject to decisions of the European Court of Justice. But actually, to a great extent, we are. Admittedly, it's not mentioned in this document. And there are these other arbitration panels and other panels that are there, which are supposed to act as, you know, the places where decisions are made about, you know, when disputes arise. But since we will be largely trading with the EU on the basis of their system of regulations and laws, on the basis of the ACQUIS, as the EU calls it, we will effect be applying European Court of Justice decisions to our law also. It may be we will get to the European Court of Justice in a more circuitous way, but that's what will continue to happen. And of course, and I come back to this, if we're talking about the European Convention on Human Rights, which the British government, the Conservatives, won an election saying they would opt out of, well, they can't do that now, because that this agreement, at least for the time being, takes that away.
Is there anything else that you see is really, really bad in this deal for the UK? Well,
I think I've summed it up. I mean, what I have not been able to do, because there just hasn't been the time in 3 hours, and it's complicated. By the way, I should make one quick observation. All EU trade agreements now have become, you know, incredibly difficult to work through, because very, very often you find that the single most important provision of all is buried in Annex 57 on page 933, and it's, you know, a some kind of subparagraph. The EU is very skilled at this, at hiding bombs in an agreement where they're not obviously visible. Now, I haven't been able in 3 hours to go through all of those details. I haven't really studied the annexes in very great detail. But I suspect that the overall contours are as I have said. I think, as I say, it's a fork in the road. Britain can move in one direction or it can move in another direction. It's very much up to the British which way they want to go. And I think that we will find, if we go through the deal in detail, that it probably doesn't change fundamentally the picture which I have said. But certainly it is not the end. It's the beginning. It is the absolute beginning of the divorce. It's not the, final. What we have this system in Britain where divorce comes in two stages. There's the preliminary decision to divorce, which is called Decree Nisi, which the court makes. And then there is the final decision of divorce, which the court makes, which is Decree Absolute. This is not Decree Absolute. This is Decree Nisi. It is a step in that direction. It is not the end of the affair.
Okay, how about fees? That 40 billion, was it 35 billion or 40 billion? That has to be paid to the EU, correct?
Yes,
what about any other fees running?
No, that's it.
Is that it? 40 billion and they're done?
That's it. They're done. That's the end of it. That is the end of it. So, I have to say, I think on balance, the British have done well. It would have been impossible to claw that money back, given that Theresa May basically gave it away. But ultimately, the rest of it, the British will no longer have to pay £350 million a week to the EU, which is what they were doing when they were full members.
Okay. And what about immigration, movement of labor, travel? I've heard kind of conflicting stories, one that the EU got the better of it, one that the UK did. I mean, how do you see that part of it?
I think the British got the better of it. Not decisively, and it can all change. But I think over time, certainly they've been able to regain. I mean, they are no longer committed to freedom of movement, and that's a fundamental principle. Because of course, if you want to be part of the single market, you have to have freedom of movement, and because they're no longer part, at least in law, part of the European single market. They're in a free trade agreement. They don't have freedom of movement. One of the things they've already done, by the way, which is actually very controversial and has caused a lot of distress with some people, especially young people, is, by way of example of what we just say, they've opted out of the Erasmus programs. Erasmus is, as many people in the United States probably don't know, but as lots of people in Europe do, it's a sort of linkage of universities which enables students from European countries to take courses in universities around Europe. And it's very popular with a lot of young British students, by the way. They like to, go off to Amsterdam or Berlin or one of those places and study in a college in one of these other countries. And it's quite a big break that's now ended. It's going to be unpopular with young people, but it is a sign that Britain is essentially ending both the free movement provisions, and that will mean that it will give it much more control over its immigration than it has up to now. So I think if you're looking at this from a pro-Brexit position, that's a big step. That's a very big step and a step forward from a pro-Brexit position.
And also when it comes to travel, just basic travel to Europe from the UK, it's going to be a 90-day, I think around a 90-day visa.
Exactly correct. So you can basically travel to Britain. You don't actually need a visa, as I understand it, but all those people I was talking about in our other live, the one that we did a few days ago, who were really angry and upset because, they couldn't travel to Britain, to Europe with their dogs and all that. Well, they can for 90 days. But if they want to stay longer, if they have Tuscan villas and residences in the south of France and all that, many wealthy British people do. Corfu also, by the way, Cyprus too. They will now need visas if they want to stay in them for more than 90 days.
Okay, Boris categorized this as a Canada-style deal. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, as I am not familiar with all the details of Canada-style deals,
Canada free trade.
This is a free trade deal. It does not make Britain a full member of the European single market, but I think it is a free trade deal which sort of leans towards keeping Britain with the option of going back into the European single market. The door remains open to do that. It would not be a difficult thing to do. So let's say in a couple of years, we have Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and he decides that Britain wants to become a full member of the European single market. He can do it very easily on the basis of this agreement. He can do it with, at the stroke of a pen. He would not, I think, need legislation to do it. And he would certainly not need a referendum to do it. So it does give that option, which, of course, Canada doesn't have.
Right, right. They've left the house, but they still have the key.
That's
they're welcome to come in at any time they want.
Yeah. That's a very, very good way of describing it. So it's not the full end of the affair. It's a step towards it, but it's not the full end of the affair. I'm going to say one final observation I would make. I mean, if you have to have a deal at all, and I know lots of people who think that it would have been better for Britain not to go for a deal, but if you're going to have a deal, then I think Boris has actually done reasonably well. I mean, this is about the best deal or the least bad deal he could have got out of the EU. And as I said, it very much follows Merkel's priorities as opposed to other people's within the EU. As I said, if it had been Macron who was running the negotiations, the outcome would have been very different. But then my sense is that if it had been Macron running the negotiations, we would have had a no-deal Brexit. And that would have been the end of the affair. So Merkel, very, very sneakily, as she always does, she keeps the doors open and gives the British the keys so that, they can come back in when they wish, if they wish. And at the same time, she protects German industries and German business. I've said this many times about Merkel. She talks integration. She does it all the time. In reality, she's always driven by narrow German domestic priorities. Now, in some ways, I think all political leaders should be driven by domestic and national priorities. But of course, with Merkel, it always comes with vast doses of moralizing and integrationist language. And it's always twisted in a way that obviously suits her, but keeps the entire EU on the road, basically as she wants it to, as she wants it to go.
Okay. Very quickly, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, how are they looking on?
Well, the Scottish are making a huge fuss about this. They're saying that, you know, there's some of their interests have been neglected. Some of the provisions, they're not happy with some of the agricultural provisions. They're going to make a big push now to go for full secession. We will see how that plays out. I doubt it, actually. I think this is my view for a long time. I think we are at peak pro-independence in Scotland. I suspect the tide of that is now going to start receding, because I think the Scots are going to go away and they're going to say to themselves, well, at the moment, even though the decision is, you know, we're not fully out, Britain is still in a position to make the ultimate decisions. So it makes more sense for us to retain a voice in London than to try and opt out totally. So I suspect there's going to be an anti-nationalist, anti-independence backlash in Scotland. Wales will go along with it because, frankly, they're tied in to the United Kingdom. There's no real secessionist sentiment in Wales, and Wales is pro-leave anyway. Northern Ireland, now that's extremely interesting, because if you remember, there were all those tensions and issues about Britain and Ireland, and about, you know, with the fact that there was a new basically border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, because Ireland would continue to remain part of the European single market and all of those things as part of Boris Johnson's withdrawal agreement. Well, that, I think, ends. I think Ireland, Northern Ireland, once again becomes reintegrated with Britain, and the zero tariff arrangement basically means that goods can continue to move backwards and forwards across the Irish border without having to pay tariffs. And I think that's going to help to keep Northern Ireland part of the UK for a while. Won't be completely frictionless. I want to make that clear. There will still be customs checks and things of that kind. But I suspect many of these problems that we've been hearing are going to melt away. I still think that Northern Ireland's trajectory is towards Irish Union, more because of political and demographic changes within Northern Ireland than for any other reason. But that will now take place over time, and it may take slightly longer, a few years longer, because of this agreement than it would have done otherwise. If there'd been a no deal Brexit, I think Irish Union would have come faster. Because we've got this agreement, it will come more slowly.
Okay, so listening to you and then listening to some of Farage's comments, I think it's safe to say that if Farage was with us right now, and there was a third window right there, and he was in on this live stream, I think you two would pretty much line up with the same outcome, with the same assessment. Correct? I mean, from what Farage said, it's, you know, I heard him, it's not the Brexit he wanted, and maybe not the Brexit he fought for, but to sum it up, I think he was pretty much along the lines of, at this moment in time, given the 4 or 5 years that we've had to fight, we finally got out of the house. We may have the keys to get back in, but we finally at least made our way out of the house.
That's right, exactly. So we're no longer within Hotel California, even though we still have the keys to the door in our pocket. Right. And that's an achievement, actually. I mean, it's taken a long time. And as I said, Boris played a very, very difficult game. And perhaps once more, as he showed last year, he's played it with more skill than many people, including myself, let me say that again, expected. He's come out with a better deal than I thought he would when we last talked about this a few days ago. It's far from perfect. It's not the end of the affair. There's still more to say. The European Court of Justice is still has a role in all of this, but we do have an ultimate way out.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like it's a 4 or 5 year transition period where it could tip either one way or another.
Precisely.
Depending on leading the country.
Precisely. Exactly.
So vigilance on the part of the yes. UK citizen as to who they vote for.
Absolutely. Now, you know, that's the other thing, because of course Farage is not getting younger, and very difficult for him to keep a political force together, you know, indefinitely, without any obvious reason to. So the risk is that he will fade from the scene now. As I said, he's always had a hankering to return to private life. He's not a natural politician, or at least not a politician who wants to be a politician, unlike most of the people in Westminster. And of course, if he disappears from the scene, if he removes himself from the scene, as he did in 2016, well, you might start to see a greater pressure towards backsliding. We shall see.
That's the risk. The backsliding is the risk. Okay, let's round this out then, Alexander, and let's take a look at this from the EU side. What are your thoughts? What are the EU bureaucrats and technocrats and the Ursula von der Leyens and the, Jean-Michel, and who are the other characters that are?
Oh, Michel.
Lagarde and all these characters. How are they viewing this?
I think they will not be happy. I mean, from their point of view, they are, if you like, the prison guards that keep everybody in. And they've now had to accept, however grudgingly, that one prisoner, an important prisoner, has escaped. So I don't think they're going to be happy with this deal. From their point of view, it's not so much that economically it damages the union in any way. It doesn't. But they now see that one important country has not only managed to leave more successfully than seemed to be likely even a week ago, but that it's now in a position to actually detach itself even further, to move even more towards a final and conclusive exit, if that's what it wants to do. So in that respect, I think those people are not going to be hugely happy. And I think that's also going to be the case, by the way, with some of the very strong pro-Brexit people in some of the countries that sense that some parts of their populations are now starting to reconsider whether they want to remain in the EU at all. So we've seen a rise of anti-EU sentiment in France, in Italy, in Spain, in countries like that. And I think the pro-EU leaders in those countries will not be happy with this, because they will see that from their point of view, the British have managed it. Maybe more and more of their people in their own countries will start to say to themselves, well, if the British can do it, so can we. So there is that force of example, and it's going to leave them unsettled. So Macron, Conte in Italy, those kind of people will not be happy with this deal. But if you are the head of Volkswagen, if you are the head of Siemens, if you are plugged into the Chancellery in Berlin, then from their point of view, those people have done very well. They're probably very happy with this agreement. It keeps trade flowing. From their point of view, it is the optimal deal, because they'll be able to continue to send their goods, their chemicals, their optical equipment, their cars, their all those things to Britain, keep it as Treasure Island for them. And not only are the barriers still low, I mean, there's still no zero tariffs. On top of all of that, they're still operating according to their regulatory framework. And if you are a Christian Democrat premier in a German land, the German Länder of the German regions, a little bit like the states in the US, then from your point of view, this also is a good deal, because it keeps the German business community, which you are ultimately responsible for, happy and strong.
All right. So once again, it's an EU outcome where Germany appears to be happy about, and then the rest of the union pretty much is non.
Agreed.
It's a no show.
Agreed. I mean, this is, of course, the other people who will probably, once they've fully digested this, will be, I think, reasonably interested are the anti-Brexit people, the anti-EU people, who, as I said, are beginning to become stronger in parts of the EU. Well, Marine Le Pen, I mean, all right, now she's talking, at the moment she's had to water down her positions. I mean, she says that she'll remain in the single currency. She says she'll remain in the EU. But I don't think many people believe that that's a conversion of any with any conviction behind it. She now sees what the British have managed, and she will probably feel, well, this is something she can talk about to people in France, and that will make her stronger in France. She can tell people in, you know, in places like Toulon, Le Havre, Marseille, that, you know, if the British can do it, so can we. The same with Salvini in Italy, for example. Those sort of people, the Vox party in Spain, they will be happy with this, because from their point of view, it advances their agenda. But overall, in terms of the EU, the people who got what they wanted are the Germans. They didn't want no deal, because that would have meant no German exports in the, you know, but they would have been able to continue to export, but they would have had to pay tariffs and all kinds of things. They would have been at much greater risk. So the Germans are happy. I think pretty much everyone else in the EU within the pro, you know, the pro-EU people are not. Except, of course, the anti-EU people, who won't be taking out champagne bottles, but they will be feeling that, you know, once again, the British have shown that if you stick to your positions, you can actually take on this thing, this monster, and you can win. Perhaps not all in one go, perhaps it's one thing at a step at a time, but you can start to move gradually, step by step out.
What about the City of London and Frankfurt and the financial centers? Which one is the City of London still going to be the place to be, or does Frankfurt have a little more sway now?
That is a very good question, and I think only time will tell. My own view is that, in spite of the fact that the City of London is now somewhat detached from the EU, I mean, this deal isn't really about services. It certainly isn't about financial services. I still think that London will remain, for the foreseeable future, far and away the biggest financial market in Europe. I mean, I don't see Frankfurt replacing it, but that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be more focus on Frankfurt now, because the British are not able to operate in Europe, their financial services, in quite the same freedom that they could previously. So the City of London people will not be happy. The legal community in Britain, who were very much connected to the City of London, they're not going to be too happy either. But, you know, the City of London is an international money market. It's global in its perspectives. It can live with this. It can carry on. It's more concerned, and has been for a long time, in fact, always, with what goes on in New York and the US than it is with what goes on in Europe.
Okay. And finally, let's touch upon the geopolitics. Do you think this frees up the UK to act more independently on its foreign policy?
Yes. And that's a major gain. I mean, now the British, I said, one of the major concerns I have is that which I touched upon in our previous life, is that other countries who wanted to do trade deals with Britain, you know, countries like the US, they might have looked at a deal that Boris came back with, which kept Britain effectively in the single market, and they would have been less keen. Well, I think they can probably say to themselves with this deal that the trajectory of Britain is still outward. So we can negotiate with the British on trade deals with reasonable confidence, and that it won't just drift back and ignore our interests. So I think countries like the US, like Canada, Australia, China, perhaps Japan, or even Russia, conceivably, will be able to negotiate with Britain, feeling that, you know, there would be some point, if you like, in doing so. So the British have achieved a significant measure of independence in setting their trade policy. It's not total, but they have achieved it. If you're talking about politics and geopolitics, Britain remains a member of NATO. Britain remains a fully committed part of the Atlanticist system. In fact, it's the most strident part of the Atlanticist system. It's the part that is most noisy in pursuing anti-Russian policies, for example. I don't think that's going to change at any time soon. Over time, if we are really talking about global Britain, which is what people like Boris Johnson said, global Britain being something very different, by the way, from a globalist Britain. A globalist Britain would be one which is integrated in structures like the EU. A global Britain is one which goes around the world cutting deals and doing the kind of things that, you know, an independent country can do. That country might start to revisit its foreign policy and might start to look at the kind of things that Winston Churchill was talking about in the 1950s, not widely known, but he wanted basically to rebalance British foreign policy. He felt that it was committing itself too much to an extreme Atlanticist position. Margaret Thatcher as well. We might start to see some sort of shifts in British foreign policy over time, but always for the British. Despite that, even if they start to do that, the great anchor will remain, for the foreseeable future, their alliance with the United States.
All right. Great. Anything else you want to touch upon, Alexander, before we get to the comments in the...
Just to say again, it's a C+. I mean, I understand a lot of people in Britain and elsewhere wanted to see a clean break Brexit. And can I just say, it's gradually come to be understood in Britain that a clean break Brexit has to be the ultimate point of destination if there's going to be a Brexit at all. I mean, this is not a simple free trade deal. I mean, I don't know what arrangements Canada has, but this is still more than just a simple free trade deal. But it is a step in that direction. It's a big step in that direction. And we will see whether or not Britain eventually takes the next step, which completes it. It's not over. We will see more. But I can understand why Farage accepts this. I think that other people who have based everything on the 40-page summary that Boris Johnson has provided should really try and read through this document. Not very easy, not very digestible, very long, but nonetheless, it's always better with EU documents to look at the full text rather than the summaries that governments produce.
Yeah, and UK citizens need to be very mindful who they vote in office going forward. Absolutely. Because that'll decide where everything moves.
Absolutely. Can I just say, I mean, the thing I had always been worried about is that we were going to end up with an agreement very like the agreements that Ukraine and Moldova made in the mid 2010s, which when I looked through them, I mean, they really did turn those countries economically into EU satellites, in which they were obliged indefinitely to apply the whole system of EU law to themselves without any voice in its making and without any way out. This is a lot better than that. So it would have been awful if Britain had found itself in the kind of situation that, you know, weak countries like Moldova and Ukraine did. But they've managed a lot better than this. It's an awful lot better than this. In fact, it's quite different from that.
Well, it's a C plus. You pass. You get through the class. It's not an A, but
you pass. It's not an A. Yeah. But realistically, given the pressure to do a deal, one wonders whether a full A would have been possible. And maybe if Dominic Cummings had been in Downing Street, perhaps that would have been what would have been achieved. But, well.
All right. Well, I'll just go back to what you said and what I said. 4 or 5 years, you're in transition, and people have to be very careful not to backslide.
Exactly. I mean, it is, in a way, it's strange to say this. Britain is still in a transition, but the trajectory of travel remains outward. But the, you know, always with the potential to reverse gear, to go into reverse gear and drive back. It's always there.
Yeah. And that's how the EU thrives on that.
Absolutely.
The EU thrives on dragging things out and just playing the long game and waiting and then sucking you back in.
Absolutely.
They always do it.
The British were very lucky that the EU is going through a major economic crisis at the moment and that the situation in Germany is looking very difficult. We haven't talked about this for a while, but there is a major economic crisis underway in Germany at the moment. So Merkel did not need a no-deal outcome at this time. She didn't want it. And when she realized that if the British were faced with the kind of Ukraine-type deal scenario, they would reject it and go for a no-deal, She immediately rode back, and we got a much, much more acceptable deal for the British than we might otherwise have done. If the Germans had felt much more confident about themselves, had felt that their economy was, you know, powering ahead on all cylinders, then the British would have found that Merkel was prepared to cut them far less slack.
Well, then you would have probably moved to
a no deal. Exactly. So that's, in a way, what the politics of Berlin have decided this more even than the politics in London.
Yeah. All right. Interesting point. Let's do some super chats and wrap it up. Let's see. From Martin, we got a super sticker. Thank you very much, Martin, for that. From Eden Taylor, £10 super chat says, Merry Christmas, gentlemen. Merry Christmas to you, Eden. And to everyone, Darren Alevi is a new member of the Durant community. Welcome, Darren. Good to have you on board. Elaine Magson sends a €5 super chat. Thank you very much, Elaine. Moon Swan Silverlight sends a £5 super chat says, Mark Fuller brought up an important point. Why aren't you two in your Santa costumes? Good point. I don't have a Santa costume.
Nor do I, actually, I have to say.
But maybe it's time to buy one. All right. And Mark Hewitt writes, what did you take from the announcement of the £16 billion increase in defense spending?
Well, that is an extraordinary step. And one wonders what the idea behind it is. Now, from a British point of view, I suppose Britain is going through a deep economic crisis, also very severe economic crisis. So you could almost see it as a sort of Keynesian move, trying to sustain parts of the British industrial economy by providing for, you know, higher defence spending. But it could also be seen as an indicator that the British are beginning to sense that the balance of power in the world is starting to shift, that Joe Biden is going to probably cut defense spending in the United States if he becomes president. And beyond that, it could also be that, you know, this is partly the perspective of a Britain that is now looking to sustain itself and act by itself. Increasing defence spending is a way, if you like, or at least announcing that you're increasing defence spending, is a way of asserting your independence too. Because by leaving the EU, Britain will not be part of any EU common militaries that, you know, the sort of ventures that Macron has been floating. So relationships with France, for example, might become weaker. Britain might feel that by itself it needs to become stronger. It's an interesting decision. It's not been fully explained, and we will see where it goes. But it's quite a big increase for Britain to actually start spending that much more money on defence than it has been doing. Obviously, these are figures that are dwarfed by those of the US, but it's still a significant increase. I gather most of it, by the way, is going into the Navy.
All right. And we have a question from Interim President Toilet Sauce. What would happen to United Russia after Putin leaves the executive? Is it, after all, a merger of three rival parties? I know this is off topic, but I missed the relevant stream. So, yeah. Alexander, what happens off topic? What happens to United Russia?
What happens to Russia once Putin leaves? It's a very fair question. Let's talk about United Russia, because, of course, Putin actually gave a very interesting talk in which he seemed to be suggesting that before very long, United Russia might no longer exist. He was talking about a Duma, a parliament, which might be completely different from the one that exists today. And that really did seem to point to United Russia, which Toilet Sauce is absolutely right. It's really a ragbag of politicians, and there's three very distinct political streams within it. That it might actually, it's never been particularly popular or particularly liked. It tends to win elections, or rather win large numbers of seats in elections, because it's Putin's party and it's the party of power. And in Russia, people tend to vote for the party that embodies the government, because that's the sort of psychology people have in Russia. But it may very well be a party that is today essentially outliving its purpose, and which we might see go. So I wonder, I don't really see United Russia myself having much future without Putin. And Putin seems to think the same thing. That would be a good thing, by the way. One of the great problems Russia has is that the political system in Russia has become frozen at roughly where it was in about, say, 2004, 2005, with this big party, United Russia, which, as I said, is not very dynamic, not very interesting, dominating the field, and with the three other mainstream parties, the Communist Party, which is very, very unlike the former Communist Party, by the way, the Communist Party, the Liberal Democratic Party, and the Just Russia Party, all run by the same people as they were run 15, 20 years ago, Zhuganov, Zhirinovsky, and Mironov. So if we start to see sort of a move away from all of this and younger people coming up, one always needs to be cautious when one talks about this in Russia, but if it can be done in a stable and orderly way, and there's some very impressive people starting to appear without, you know, the whole thing going to pieces, then, you know, we could, that would actually probably be a good thing. And moving away from the sort of the old titans of the Yeltsin era towards a sort of more up-to-date political system. But it has to be managed very carefully and over a certain period of time, because in Russia, when you try to carry out changes like that, things can go horribly wrong, as they did in the 1980s. And that always has to be the worry.
All right. From Robert Simone, thank you, gentlemen, for your work. Always a joy to watch you. Happy Christmas to you both. And let's still hope in Trump 2020. All right, Alexander, let's still hope for Trump in 2020 is what Roberto says. Quick question. Let's just dig into that one real quick. Veto of the, was the NDAA, the National Defense, is that what it's called, the NDAA, where he vetoed that bill? And let me know in the live chat if I'm saying that correctly. And of course, you have the stimulus, which is, he didn't say he's going to veto it. He says he's not going to accept it. He pushed for $2,000. Mm-hmm. A stimulus check. Well done. I agree with that. And Pelosi now is going to bring it up for a vote on Monday again. The Republicans, the GOP, have said that they're not going to support the $2,000. Everything, all the pork stays in there. All of that stuff doesn't leave. All the money to special interests will not leave. But they're trying to now find a way to up it from 600 to 2,000. So we have some moves being made by the Trump White House. We also have a lot more Republican House members who are going to be questioning the electors as well.
Well,
a lot have come out, actually, a good amount. But the Senate, from what I'm understanding, is still maybe Rand Paul and a couple. But anyway, those are the latest moves that that we've been following.
I think these are enormously important moves, actually. I think that they deserve a detailed and full discussion, which perhaps we should do shortly, because what they show is that Trump is far from quitting. I mean, he's not quitting in terms of his contest between now and in the inauguration, but even after the inauguration, assuming it goes the way that everybody expects. The main pundits are saying it will go. Even afterwards, he's still very clear that he's going to remain on the political scene, and he's saying what he wants to do. And of course, on the defense issue, what he's basically saying is that he wants to see Section 230 go, at least in its present form. So that's a direct challenge to the big tech companies, something we've discussed many times in our programs and have said he should have done before, but that's a major challenge there. And on the relief bill, well, I think this is an even bigger thing because it smokes out simultaneously both the Republican and the Democrat establishments. The Republicans, because they're only prepared to provide, $600 to people, which is, I believe it's even means tested, which is ridiculous. And the Democrats, because as you said, all the pork is still there. So they're all into corruption and, special interests and lobbying and all those things. And of course, they were also prepared to accept $600. So I think Donald Trump is saying, look, I am the person who ultimately fights for the people of America. I want a proper stimulus bill, one which will really assist people, not, with small handouts and lots of favors to the well-connected, but which is really geared towards helping people in the US, families, working families in the US, was really focused on the people themselves. And with the defense bill, I really am prepared to take on the tech companies. I'm also going to push further to stop all these wars, because of course another aspect of this defense bill is that it makes it almost impossible to withdraw troops in the Middle East. Well, he's saying very clearly, I think, that he wants to continue that process of bringing the troops home. So I think this is a very important political step by Trump, and it makes it absolutely clear in the starkest possible way that he is not gone, irrespective of what happens on the 20th of January. He's taking the fight against the tech companies, against the establishment of the Republican Party, of the GOP, and obviously against the Democrats too. And he's outflanking the Democrats on their, as the champion of the working people and the working families of America, which is, of course, what the Democrats used to claim to be. So it's very astute politics, very strong moves, and not to be underestimated. And they show that, you know, Donald Trump remains a warrior and he's far from giving up.
Yeah, just a couple of things on the Section 230. Yeah, we've been advocating so much getting rid of Section 230, but giving it some teeth. In other words, getting rid of Section 230 would definitely hurt a lot of small businesses and small networks. But what they have to do is they have to give Section 230 teeth. They have to enforce it. That's what they have to do. And the minute that Twitter or Facebook starts to censor anybody, then they lose their platform status and go straight into being a publisher. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, my question to you is, the big loser in all of this, and I think Trump's move was really interesting, because the big loser was not really Pelosi. It was Mitch McConnell and the GOP establishment, because what Pelosi did was, the minute Trump said 2,000, she tweeted out and said, yes, 2,000, let's do it. I mean, okay, she took a jab at Trump, as she always does, but who cares? She does that all the time. But she said, yes, let's do 2,000. And then what she did is she brought it up to the House, and the vote had to be, I forgot what type of vote it's called, but if there's just one person that votes no, then it's over. She did that knowing that the Republicans would definitely not go along with it.
Yes.
So the Republicans shot it down. And now on Monday, she's going to try to rework a roll call vote. In other words, just try to get a majority on the 2000s. So what Nancy Pelosi did is she, it was a great move by Trump, but then it was also a clever move on Pelosi's part, in a way, to call out to paint the Republican GOP as the bad guys. And I think she's doing that because she's looking forward towards Georgia and that vote over there. So there's a lot of political gamesmanship going on. But in this case, I think the Republican establishment and Mitch McConnell specifically, they lost out, because they were exposed as voting against the 2000. And that's going to hurt them in Georgia, I think. And Pelosi's going to use that, and Trump has exposed them as not being for the people. McConnell lost out on that big time.
Trump is absolutely furious with McConnell, and there's no doubt about that at all. And obviously, the Republicans have shown, the Republican establishment has shown remarkably little support for Trump. In fact, they haven't been supportive of Trump at all. And it needs to be said, at any part of his presidency. I mean, going all the way back to the time of his inauguration. I mean, they kept Mueller going. They had all that information about Mueller, which they still persisted in saying to Trump, you know, that he shouldn't do anything against Mueller because Mueller is so important and all that. They didn't help Trump repeal Obamacare when it could have been done. And of course, he's not happy with their moves over the last couple of weeks. And we've discussed that in previous programs, but we have to be obviously careful what we say. But so he's not happy with McConnell. And he has, as you absolutely rightly say, exposed McConnell as someone who's happy to support a stimulus bill that contains lots of pork, lots of help for special interests and well-connected people, but is not really supporting the working families of America. Donald Trump says, I'm prepared to do that. Pelosi has to follow, because, of course, that's traditionally been the Democrats' pitch, that they support the working families of America. But remember, she was prepared to sign off on this stimulus bill before. I mean, she went along with it. So it's open for Trump to say, well, she's only doing that because of the position I have taken. So the fact that Pelosi is sort of shifting ground shows the extent to which Donald Trump in the United States at the moment is still making the weather, the political weather. Things are still revolving around him. People are still looking to what he's saying, what he's going to do, what he's thinking is, and they're having to make their decisions around it. And you're quite right. Mitch McConnell looks like he's coming out of this very badly. Pelosi is adjusting. I'm not sure it's going to make much of a difference in the Georgia votes, but it may do. And as I said, Donald Trump once more has reasserted himself and looks again like the formidable political player that he now is. I predict we will see and hear an awful lot more from Trump, not just over the next few weeks, but over the next few years, irrespective of what happens on January 20th.
Yeah, that move to me signifies the fact that the Republican base is with Trump. They are not with McConnell.
Correct. Correct.
No doubt about it.
Absolutely. And as you rightly said, you can see that in the House, there are lots of Republicans. The House Republicans always been closer to the voters because they're voted every 2 years. Senators are only voted every 6 years. They're much closer to the voters. And of course, they're closer in the, you know, the congressional districts than the senators are. They are much closer to Trump than they are, than the senators are. And of course, the congressional Republicans, the House Republicans, give Trump credit, which he deserves, for the fact that they clawed back so much ground in the House during the election, and they're now within hitting distance of regaining control of the House in 2022.
Yeah, the Republican House members, though, should have gone along with the 2000.
Yeah, I agree.
That was a big mistake, and I agree. If it's as it gets brought up for another vote, which I think it will get brought up, they should go along with it, and then it should get passed on to McConnell's hands. We should see what happens there. That'll be interesting.
That'll be very interesting. Can I just make a quick observation? The point is that far too many House Republicans, even those who tend to support, or at least to have some ideological and a political affinity for Trump, still think in terms of conventional politics.
Pelosi knew that.
Exactly. They observe party discipline. They still follow the dictates of what people like McConnell say. The point about Trump and what makes him different is that he has upturned conventional politics. He did so from the moment he first announced that he was a candidate for the presidency back in 2015.
Yeah, Pelosi knew that.
Absolutely.
That's why Pelosi went through with
with
Trump's suggestion. She knew what was going to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A lot of politicking going on in D.C.
Absolutely.
Still.
Absolutely.
A lot of stuff going on, and we have January 6th, and I think more masks will be coming off. Let's see.
Well, indeed. I mean, I should say that I've seen some surveys from Georgia, by the way, which strongly suggest that the Republicans are heading towards at least holding on to one of those seats, perhaps even two. But, you know, obviously the polling is complicated and very difficult, and the money is pouring in to support the Democrats. And, of course, there's always the problems with the voting system. Again, I have to be very careful what I say. But at the moment, it does look as if the Republicans are going to win one seat at least, because the candidate, one of the Democrat candidates, Reverend Warnock, apparently is someone with views which, shall we say, are unconventional and have left him open to challenge on many fronts.
Yeah. There was a video that came out where he ran over his wife's foot with his car or something. Just really bizarre stuff. And the guy's really, the guy's kind of out there.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see. We'll see. We got some big days ahead of us.
Absolutely.
Big days ahead of us.
Absolutely.
We'll be reporting on that.
Of course.
But let's wrap it up here, Alexander. We have some big days ahead of us, but it looks like we may have kind of close the chapter in Brexit a little bit.
Well, for the moment.
For the moment.
It's not the end. Again, I want to repeat this again. It is not the end of the affair. We're going to be seeing a lot more coming. It's going to take a long time to play itself fully out. It is not the end of the affair. But at the same time, changing the metaphor, it's a big step forward. As you rightly said, Britain is out of the door, it's still got the keys in its pocket. It decides to turn round and walk back in, which it might do under a Keir Starmer government, that option is still there. They could still do it. The attractions of Hotel California, which are not very obvious to me, might still, you know, lure it back in. But it has left. It's got out through the main door. It's left Hotel California. A term, by the way, that Yanis Varoufakis, I understand, came up.
All right. Let's do some more super chats. Moon Swad Silverlight says, Halo is equal to Saint Christopher. Ah. Thank you very much for that super chat, Moon Swad Silverlight from QLAM is now part of the Durant community. Welcome, QLAM, to the community. And Mark Hewitt writes, 2021 will probably see an influx of refugees from Hong Kong into the UK. What should the UK government do not to plan for this?
Well, they do need to plan for this, and they need to think about this through very, very carefully, because obviously these people probably will want to come. And I would say... In fact, there's actually an article in the Daily Telegraph which says the Hong Kongers are coming and we are not prepared. What I would say is these will tend to be, I would have thought, rather high value people. I mean, fairly well trained, fairly entrepreneurial, business people, kind of people who integrate well in the British business community. And the Chinese community in Britain is quite big and surprisingly has never been one that has attracted any, well, maybe not surprisingly, has never attracted very much controversy. So the British need to prepare. They need to work very fast. They need to think a lot about what they're going to do. And they also need to get some idea of what the numbers might be and whether they can actually absorb all those numbers. I doubt we're looking at millions of people, despite what people say, because life in Hong Kong, for many people, will continue much as before. And, you know, not everybody is very political, but some of the more, shall we say, entrepreneurial people from Hong Kong might come, and Britain does need to start preparing for them.
All right. Great. That was a good update. Excellent update. I think we covered a lot of ground there.
Yeah.
So we will leave it there. We'll end this live stream there. Let's see, to Danny and Spartan Warrior Queen, thank you very, very much for your moderation. Thank you to everyone that participated in the live stream and took some time out of your Saturday to listen to what we had to say about Brexit, to listen to what Alexander had to say about Brexit, and to all the super chats and all the support. Thank you very, very much, everybody. We will leave it there. Any final words, Alexander, before we sign off?
Always a pleasure to speak to people. And as I said, this is not going to be the last live we're going to do on Brexit. I am sure there's going to be more coming. But I think that we are probably going to be able to take a break for it for a while. It's been a long, tangled and very difficult road, far more difficult than it seemed in 2016 when the Brexit referendum happened. But it seems we have managed to get at least most of the way. And I have to finish by saying, you know, I've been critical of Boris Johnson in many respects. I think he's come out with a much better deal than most people expected that he would. He's again shown that in a negotiation, he may not be somebody who understands detail very well, but he does understand what the weaknesses of the other side are. And he's been able to use them. He used Macron very skillfully to get his withdrawal agreement sorted. He cut out Merkel and went to Macron last year and got a deal that was able to pass the British Parliament. And this time round, he was able to get a deal that was able to open the way up for him to get a general election. And this time round, he's got a deal by cutting out Macron and going to Merkel instead. So he's shown that he's able to play Macron and Merkel off against each other pretty well. And we should give him credit for that. He's shown more skill than certainly I expected.
All right. We'll leave it there. Take care, everybody. Have a good weekend.